You're listening to The Parting Shot with H. Allen Scott.
So today I'm speaking with comedian Alex Edelman, who kind of accidentally stumbled upon a meeting of white nationalists. Now, that would be weird for probably anybody, hopefully anybody, but particularly for Edelman, who is Jewish. Let me just play a little bit of the trailer for his new HBO comedy special called Just For Us, just to give you a little taste of it.
I grew up in Boston. I grew up in this really racist part of Boston called Boston. It's a Tuesday night, and I'm doing my favorite thing. When I'm alone, I lie on my couch, and I hold my phone like an otter, like an inch from my face. And I see this tweet, and I send it to my best friend in the world, and I wrote, David, do you want to come with me to this meeting of Nazis in Queens? By the way, nothing says white privilege more than a Jew walking into a meeting of racists and thinking, this will probably be fine. It's Queens, the most diverse borough. You can't even get 17 Nazis together without a Jew being set right there in the middle of you. There's a huge part of me that genuinely walked into this room thinking, like, they're just anti-Semites because they haven't met Alex yet. At some point, this guy two seats away from me went, Jews are sneaky and they're everywhere. And I was like...
I have to tell you, this special is so, so good. You need to watch it. It's the definition of the power of comedy and live performance, like the power of a great story, just a great story. And he's such a good storyteller. It will have an impact on you. I guarantee it. And please do let me know after you watch it on social media. I want to hear your thoughts. But I also need to selfishly do something because my chat with Alex was just so great that I never got around to telling him the story, this little story about me. You see, his name, Alex Edelman, reminds me of a friend from my childhood whose bar mitzvah was the first bar mitzvah I ever went to. I grew up in a small town and there weren't many Jews in my small town, so I literally only went to one bar mitzvah. And I was raised Mormon. I am now Jewish, but I was raised Mormon. And my mom loves to play practical jokes on me. So when I was going to this bar mitzvah, my mom told me that they circumcised the boy at the bar mitzvah. And I believed her because, you know, why wouldn't I believe mom? And I go to the bar mitzvah and I was one of those kids who talked to everybody and who loved to gossip and all of those things. I mean, I made a career of it now, but you know, back then I was still doing it in a very small scale way. And I went around to every one of my friends and I told him, you know, we're about to see, you know, who get circumcised. And so everyone, I spread the word. And then I worked myself up so much that I did not want to go see this person get circumcised. I did not want to see it at all. And so I went up to his mother and I said, great party, you know, but I don't think I can see him get circumcised. And she just sort of looked at me in a strange way. And then she gently grabbed my hand and she led me over to a table of mostly middle-aged women and of all different ages, I would say. And she told me, I want you to say exactly what you just told me to this table. And so I love an audience. And so I did. And I said, I don't think I can see him get circumcised. And the whole table busted out laughing. And it was embarrassing for me, of course, because I thought they were laughing at me. But also a part of me kind of loved it because it was my first joke that I didn't know was a joke that landed. And I had an audience and they loved it. And that moment sticks out with me because there are stories like that and moments like that in our lives that just sort of just become these center points for stories that we tell throughout our lives. And that's why I do what I do. And that's why Alex does what he does. And that's why we tell these stories to sort of narrate our lives and sometimes make life a little bit better. And I can tell you that Just For Us by Alex Edelman, his live show, will make your life a little bit better. And it'll make you look at things a little bit differently. And it'll make you look at the possibility of different stories differently and what you can do with a story and just the power of a great story. So I'm glad I was able to share that. So let's get to it. Grab a snack because I will be right back with Alex Edelman.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I loved the special. I was so bummed I never got to see it live when I was here in Los Angeles because I was away on work. So like,
it's coming back.
Oh, so it is a win.
It's last run, the last run of the show ever.
Okay.
March 25th to 31st.
Oh, wonderful. Well, then I'm in town, so I definitely will come. That's fantastic. But I loved the special. I think it's so fantastic and original and different. And I wanted to know, how did it go from this story that you're telling people and maybe workshopping in different spaces, as you know, as we as comics sort of do in these weird little nuggets of corners of the world, to it being the Broadway sensation that it became?
I mean, I'm gonna try to do this in a concise way, but I was thinking of this on my bike today. Not to brag that I bike. You know, other people really made it happen. You know, the people who I told the story to, who would ask provocations story-wise, or the advocates for this story who said this is something slightly bigger, you know. But I told it at a storytelling night in New York in front of like 32 people, and then in London in a pub behind a shoe store, and then it started at Soho. But my director, Adam Brace, was the guy who really I owe two people really big time. I owe Adam Brace and I owe Mike Birbiglia. And also in terms of the special, I owe Alex Timbers, who had the only vision for how to translate this to film. But yeah, it was those guys, Brace and Birbiglia, who initially sort of elevated the show. Brace did it first, and then Mike came in and was like, I'm sorry, but you need to change this, this, and this. Mike made like six notes, but they were all life-changing notes, and they were really big. But every comedy legend who came to the show had asked them for help. So like, Billy Crystal is the reason they use one of these mics instead of one of these mics. It was the biggest note that I got from one of those big guys. Seinfeld gave a great note. You know, Steve Martin gave me a joke for the show. So, you know, of course he liked the show. It was co-written by Steve Martin.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, how does that feel, though? I mean, I just know for me, like, you know, working in the industry and sort of talking to different people, it is sort of a pinch me moment when Steve Martin talks to you. Or like, I remember years ago at the beginning of Twitter, Steve Martin like retweeted one of my tweets, and it was literally a life changing moment for me. And it was just Twitter. So like, you have it. I mean, he gave you a joke for a show that's now on HBO. What is that like for you, that these comedy legends that you probably admired are talking to you even?
I mean, it's the best thing in the world. I do this because I'm a fan. Yeah. I'm not sure if anyone, maybe I'm not supposed to stop admitting that at some point, but I just always loved stand-up. I always wanted to be a stand-up. I always thought that stand-up was the most fun, cool, delightful thing in the world. And I've fallen in love with different things, poetry, writing, pottery, you know, different types of sports. I've gone through phases. But my love of stand-up and wanting to be a stand-up, want to be part of this community of, like, comedians, but also wanting to sort of diversify what comedy can be in terms of its aesthetic and its content, right? Like sometimes people come up to me after the show, they're like, you know, I don't like comedy, but I like this. And I'm like, well, you're just not getting the right kind of comedy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but like, I always wanted to be part of this community of people. And then when I got to New York, I wanted to be part of the theater community also. So like, when those people come and you feel the immediacy of that community in your face, that's sort of like, I've never wanted to be famous, but I've always wanted, I mean, this feels grosser, but I've always wanted the respect of my peers. And I've always wanted to be thought of as worth reckoning with by people that I reckoned with growing up.
I mean, what is that? There's that expression, like, it's not how many people know you, it's who knows you. There's like, it's something like that, which I think is so true, in that like, if you're respected by the people you respect, well then fame's irrelevant. You know what I mean?
You know, the funny thing is that I've always, the people that most excite me in terms of coming to the show, like Jeannie Berlin came to the show, you know, and Elaine May was going to come and family emergency, but Elaine is, and Norman Lear was a really big encourager of mine. And when the day after opening, I got a FaceTime from Norman Lear. He was like, those reviews, you know,
it's probably the only 100-year-old FaceTime you've ever had from.
Oh yeah. 1,000%. But, it's really important to me. Like, there's one of my favorite comics is this guy named Tom Lehrer, and he's a bit of a recluse. He's in his 90s now. You know, sometimes I knock on his door.
Yeah.
Sometimes he lets me in and sometimes he shoos me away. But, like, I've loved comedians my whole adult life. And so to do a show that they come to see is really special to me.
Definitely. Well, for me, I mean, obviously, as a Jew, I'm going to have a reaction to this show like that. That's just a natural thing for me. But what kind of reaction have you had from the Gentiles? What kind of reaction from non-Jews have you had?
No, I wrote the show for Gentiles. Like, I never thought of it with what I'm very happy that Jews feel seen by the show. That's really wonderful because, you know, I am one and it would have been nice to have a piece like this when I was growing up. But I wrote the show for Australians and Scots. In its first two iterations. Our audiences are largely non-Jewish. We have sometimes I'll go to a city and I'm like, oh, they turned out the Jewish community for this one in terms of, like, you know, the audience will be like 60% Jewish or something like that. But, like, it's a comedy show. The show is, like, just full of jokes and the show is just full of, so yeah, non-Jewish audiences seem to appreciate it just as much. And in some cases I say this to people and they can't believe it, but I'm like, some cases more, they're not hung up on the, just like a fun, good story to them.
Yeah.
But I love anyone who comes see a show. I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, I know. Anyone who's in a seat, that works for me. In a show you talk about, and what I thought was so interesting is you talk about performing and sort of how we're all kind of performing in little bits and pieces and stuff. And I mean, for me as a queer Jewish person, I definitely relate to the idea of, like, sometimes I have to switch how I present myself or how I respond, sure, or how I do things. And just to work, even in this industry, I have to switch how I even talk to straight dudes sometimes. So I wanted to know if doing this show and the reception that it's received, has it heightened your awareness of those moments in which in your everyday life or maybe in work that you are performing as sort of, you're maybe concealing the Jewishness or not, or you know what I mean?
It's not my Jewishness that I feel the need to perform. It's because I'm actually very comfortable in my Jewishness. So it's one of the few things, that's probably the only thing I'm comfortable in. So I never play more or less Jewish. I sort of show up as I am. But there are other things. I will pretend to be smarter than I am, or I will pretend to be dumber than I am, or I will pretend to be more or less local than I am, depending on, you know, who is there, or depending on how I think. When I'm in the UK, I get to, sometimes I spend a lot of time in the UK, and sometimes I will find myself being more American because I realize that in that situation, to be less attuned to whatever is happening is actually an advantage, right? Like, you know, code switching, to use a phrase that is, you know, to broadly apply that phrase that has, you know, more import for different people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something that we all do. Oh, no, it's not my Judaism where I'm performing. I'm performing in that one specific space. I'm performing less Judaism. But even then, when they were like, yeah, I don't want to ruin the show for anybody. But yeah.
Well, I mean, in terms of the conversation around performing and the broadly, you know, used term code switching, there is, especially right now as a Jew, there is a complication, especially when you're a public Jew. And I mean, I've experienced this just online. Even just being Jewish online has been kind of thorny for me lately in the sort of post October 7th, post all of that. And I wanted to know, I don't want to get into that situation because that's a whole other conversation, but
ask whatever you want.
But I do want to talk about, you know, being a public Jew, especially now with this special and with it coming out, you're going to be even more public as a Jew. Has it become complicated in the light of sort of the culture that we're in right now? And what are you experiencing right now with the show?
I actually, like, obviously, I, you know, feel huge. These are good questions. Obviously, I feel such complication around, like, October 7th and, you know, and its aftermath. But, like, I don't feel weird about my Judaism. Like, I don't feel weird about, like, I think my Judaism has given me, there are things that I don't like about being Jewish. There are things that I like find challenging, I guess, but like it also, look, just in terms of applying it to this like conflict, Judaism, I think, teaches something that is, in its traditional sense, not something that we're used to in American discourse, which is the idea of holding two seemingly contradictory notions at once and trying very hard to reconcile. And so, like, especially in the instance of October 7th, where there's so much pain on so many sides, and everyone's got so many differing data sets that they're operating of, opinions, you know, things that they're deciding to look at, things that they're deciding to ignore, that viewpoint of, you know, zooming out to a above a bird's eye view, but also being conscious of a bug's eye view, understanding the responsibility that you have as an individual, what you owe to various collectives, like those tensions. I mean, my Judaism informs that, but like, I feel very, like I said, like I perform a lot. I am deeply insecure. I am very scared all the time that I have done something that will get me in trouble, or that I will do something, or that I'll say the wrong thing. But like in my Judaism, like I don't see myself as like in this sphere as like simply a Jew. Judaism is a huge part of who I am. I'm very proud of it generally. But like I perform for non-Jewish audiences. I'm very accessible. I have many non-Jewish, most of my friends are not Jewish just because of the percentages.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, being a public Jew, it's put me in a position to speak to young Jews in a way that I wish I had been spoken to as a younger Jew. But besides that, like, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. No, I was kind of joking. I haven't seen the movie yet. I'm dying to see the movie.
Like, you haven't seen the movie? How have you not seen Barbie yet?
I haven't seen Barbie. You know why? I'm not kidding. I literally have a DVD. I'm saving it for a day. I'm really sad because I know I'm going to love it.
That is the most Jewish thing you can say.
I have things that I ration. Like yeah. There's a book by Sloane Crosley that's coming out. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm going to love, I love Sloane Crosley's writing. So I read the book like a few pages at a time and then put it away like it's a treat. Like it's a nice candy bar I'm saving for later, you know?
Yes. I do the same thing with Real Housewives. Yep. Totally.
Are you a Salt Lake? I'm a Miami person.
Oh, that's so interesting. No, I've never met a Miami person. I'm a Beverly Hills, New York, Salt Lake person.
I mean, they're messy down in Miami.
I know. I need to get into Miami. I do.
Well, Andy Cohen came to the show. He's like, what was your favorite Housewives? I was like, I couldn't. I gave him like a nothing answer. He looked at me so disappointed. I'm just.
Well, which one did you say?
I think I said Salt Lake, but everybody says Salt Lake.
Oh, know. I mean, especially this year. Yeah, everyone says Salt Lake. Well, I wanted to know, because one of the things that I find so interesting is sort of those post-shows conversations, you know, and whatever's happening in the ether, in the world, often dictates some of those conversations. And even like with my own stand-up, like if I'm talking about anything queer of the moment after the show, the conversation is just that. So I wanted to know, considering, of course, now with the climate as well, have the post-show conversations, what kind of questions have you been asked post-show? And have they changed over the course of the show?
People ask me if anyone from the white nationalists meeting has seen the show. and I have no idea. If you guys do, please get in touch. somebody asked me once. I thought I saw one of them in Union Square, but I was going to go up to them and be like, sorry, do I believe we're a meeting of white nationalists in Queens? Like, I thought that would be a bad idea.
Yeah.
People ask me a lot. People ask me if I'm afraid. I'm not, but there are a few days where someone said that they were going to come to San Francisco on October 29th and behead me in front of my Zionist buddies. And I was like, well, the shows end on October 28th. I'm not going to like stay an extra day to get beheaded, you know, like I'm getting out of town. Also, the guy was like a teenager from like Tunisia. I don't know that he had all of his like Delta miles together to come like behead me.
Also, San Francisco is not the city. I mean, choose a more conservative city. Come on.
Yeah, of course. It's not going to happen. But no, there generally, by the way, that was a moment of like very heightened rhetoric and I shut off comments and, you know, became a little more selective in DMs after that. But like, you know, I'm not afraid. And also, you know, but in terms of questions. People ask like very granular questions about the show. People ask about my family life. People ask my opinions on things like October 7th. Like, I'm always happy to like talk person to person about like pretty much anything. It's a very like fun and interesting. I like hard conversations.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Again, a very Jewish response. complicated questions. Please. Do you know a comic named Brent Sullivan at all?
Yes. How do I know that name?
He's just a great comic. He and I do a podcast together, but he does exactly that. Whenever someone says something controversial, he just gets up to the mic and goes, "How dare you?" It's the perfect response.
No, but I mean, like, also people ask me about other comics that I love. People ask me about, like, you know, specific pieces of work. People ask me if I've read like one of five books that they always think I should read. I've read them all. But like, it's interesting to do a show that's so clearly a comedy show, but also has other elements to it.
Yeah.
Like, to have a story that keeps people engaged, you know, like, it's been really like, and people have their own takes on the story, which is so interesting. Mm-hmm. People have their own takes on like the characters contained within it, little details. Sometimes people really get hung up on a detail about like, you know, they'll be like, "Oh man, this thing, you know, this character, they remind me, is it this person that I know?" And I'm all like, "No," or like,
"How do I?"
Also, a lot of characters are like composites or like, you know,
yeah.
If I didn't remember something, I like, you know, the show is like exaggerated the way that comedy shows are exaggerated. So like,
yeah.
Sometimes I have to remind people that the show is not a think piece, that the show is like entertaining. Like, I am so there to entertain. Mm-hmm. So when everyone's like thinks of it as like a treatise on white nationalism, we're always like, "There's a book. You should read a book. You should, you know, watch TED Talk." It's never going to be this.
Yeah.
And people love to tell me their stories of having Christmas, because there's a story about our family having Christmas. Mm-hmm. And people love to come up to me, Jews, non-Jews, tell me their stories of how they had Christmas. And I love that so much. It's so nice. It's so cute. It's adorable. Yeah. People tell me their Christmas stories. I die. Like, I just like, I love hearing about how people celebrate. Or people tell me about the time that they celebrated a holiday for someone from another religion. Mm. Someone had nowhere to go for like Ramadan break fast, or like, you know, or Easter or Passover. And they threw them. I was stuck in the Everglades once on Hanukkah. My friend Michael cut an apple in half and made a menorah out of it. Like, it was really the cutest thing in the world. So like, I love hearing any sort of like interfaith story is like the most delightful thing.
Oh, that's adorable. I love that. Well, that kind of got me to, I mean, in terms of sort of how you shape the show and how, I mean, talking, because this is like, it's a, even though it's entertaining, it is, there are themes in it that are complicated and deep. Mm. And I mean, even just with myself, like years ago, I had cancer, I'm okay. But when I started talking about it in my stand-up and in my work, I noticed that my work shifted, that my jokes became more nuanced and different. I wasn't doing the kind of jokes I was doing, you know, when I first started out. They weren't silly sex jokes. They became sort of different in a way. And I wanted to know how doing this show has changed your approach to how you write the comedy that you do.
What a brilliant question. Frankly, you know, I don't know yet, because honestly, everything that I've thought, you know what it has done? It's made me find little jokes and choices. It made me realize that comedy can come from smaller things. The show has made me bigger, because I play these big spaces, or I play spaces that are much bigger than I used to. You know, sometimes the spaces are like 3,000 seats or so. And it's also made me smaller in realizing that like you can go quiet and get like, so in terms of how I perform, it's certainly changed me a huge amount. And also doing literally thousands of hours of comedy.
Yeah.
You know, I've done the show probably hundreds of times. It's an hour and a half. It's like a lot. But I've done a lot of comedy now. Mm-hmm. But like, in terms of what I write, I think the jokes have, I have a higher standard, obviously. Like, I perform every joke. Like, Jerry Seinfeld might see it at some point. So sometimes I go, would I want Seinfeld to see that joke? Would I want the recently deceased poet Luis Gluck to see that joke? I don't know. You know, I just,
yeah.
I'm much more conscious of that. Also, you know, you do a joke X number of times, you start to form an ethic around the joke that you, mm-hmm. you know, when I, my first show, there was a joke about someone's weight. And it wasn't a fat joke. It wouldn't even be taboo now, I don't think. Or it was a fat joke, but it wasn't like at the expense of a specific person. But I just made a joke about how someone's weight, I say it was in pounds. And then I go, you know, in England, they use stone. So I'd say the person was one boulder, which is a good joke technically, right? It's a good joke, gets a laugh. You know, this isn't about like punching down, because I think that's a lazy, what people are like, that joke punches up, that joke punches down. And yeah. I'm like, oh no, things can be more complicated than that sometimes. But like, after a while, certain jokes like stop sitting well with you and you cut them. And there were a few jokes in my show that just stopped sitting well with me. So I cut them. And then there are jokes that audiences owe at, and I like that they owe it. You know, like I have a joke about like the assassination of JFK, and you know, like it's fine. It's long ago enough now, and more of a popular thing, and like it's absolutely fine. But there are jokes about other people in the show that I've like taken out, and even jokes at the white nationalists' expense seemed a little gratuitous. I was like, ah, enough. So.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like that mentality. I hate those comics who are sort of very curmudgeon in the sort of like, you can't tell me what I can talk about. And no one's telling you what you can and can't talk about. It's just you don't have to be an asshole.
I don't know. I think everyone, but you know what's strange? One person's personal ethic is not another person's personal ethic.
True.
And so sometimes they get a little tetchy about like, you know, someone going, well, that person can't say this. I'm like, well, that's, you know, by the way, I don't think that you can't say anything now. Like, I think it's never been a better time. To look, there are more tensions than ever, and comedy is about the building and release of tension in part. So, like, you know, play with the tensions, deal with the new tensions, think thoughtfully about those new tensions. But, like, at the same time, there are comics that do jokes that I consider to be homophobic that I wouldn't laugh at. There are comics that I consider that do jokes that I consider to be racist or sexist or in, you know, I'm an anti-Semitism minimalist, but like, but anti-Semitic occasionally. And I'm like, well, that joke, I don't like that joke very much. I think that joke's kind of shitty. And I would never publicly criticize another comic for their jokes because my line shifts so often. Yeah. But like, yeah, I think less sometimes of other comics for, you know, their bad, late, stupid writing. So, yeah.
Totally. I mean, I think less of a lot of people a lot of the time, but I would never share it necessarily publicly.
Never share it in this public forum, you know?
No, never. But I'll DM you. I'll DM you the ones
I really want that. And I really want to know which comedian we're both talking about. But, like, you know who I really have a bone to pick with? Recently deceased poet Louise Gluck. Well, you know what? She needs to be taken down the peg.
Well, my last question for you is what's next for you? What do you hope to do after all of this? I mean, how do you follow this?
You know, I've been doing the show in part for 6 years and I need the brain space back. You know, I'm writing television. Hopefully I do some acting. I'm writing a book on places I don't belong called I Don't Belong Here. Suggestions welcome. I'm going to see Louis Farrakhan speak on Sunday in Detroit. Oh, wow. So that'll be an interesting.
That's an interesting place for you to go. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to wear a bow tie, so I'll fit in, you know. but I don't know exactly what something like that'll be, but like my brain is going to have to start gathering again. And also, I'm writing and directing a Christmas movie.
Oh, that's fun.
Based on
in the grand tradition of Jews directing Hollywood Christmas movies. Yes,
absolutely. You know, they had Norman Jewison, who wasn't actually Jewish, directing Fiddler on the Roof. So it's time for one of us to do it. Yeah, I'm going to do that. And I've got a bunch of ideas. So
nice.
We'll see which ones flower.
I can't wait. Let me know what you thought of today's episode. I'm H. Allen Scott on everything, and leave a little rating and review wherever you're listening to this. It really does help me out. And maybe message me about, you know, that whole circumcising bar mitzvah story thing too, because I can't live that one down. For the latest news and podcasts, go to Newsweek.com and follow Newsweek on all the social platforms and subscribe to my newsletter For the Culture. Lots of things. It's coming out Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays now, which is very exciting. So go subscribe to that. That means people are subscribing. So thank you. Until then, watch something fun and have a great day.